The celebrations and commemorations of our Jewish calendar have come zipping by at a rapid pace. 2 weeks ago, we observed Passover, and just a few weeks before, we partied at Purim. Last week, we commemorated Yom HaShoah. Yesterday, as I said, we celebrated the 70th anniversary of Israel's rebirth. It was Yom HaAtzma'ut. Modern Israel is 70 years old. Tonight, we're still in the middle of counting down the Omer. And in less than a couple weeks, we'll be celebrating Lag BaOmer. And then, shortly thereafter, it's time for Shavuot. So, just what's going on in our crazy, crammed calendar? Well, I want to explore that with you a bit further tonight. And, in fact, the days between Passover and Shavuot are kind of what we call Kol HaMoed, intermediate days, not of the festival, but between the festival of Passover and Shavuot, between the festival of our freedom and our festival of first fruits, as celebrated in Jerusalem. It's not as if they are, in fact, intermediate days. So, how can one rejoice, one might suggest, on Independence Day, on Yom HaAtzma'ut, with the perennial threat of rockets and the growing threat of a nuclear Iran? In order to understand, we must perhaps probe the hidden significance of the matzah, as well as the curious lack of a specific name for the festival of Shavuot, the festival of weeks. That hardly seems appropriate, because after all, this simply connotes or merely connotes the period leading up to the festival rather than the festival itself. Now, there are many commentators in our history who see the word matzot, the plural of matzah, as being identical with the word mitzvot, plural of mitzvah, or a behavior that's in keeping with God's instructions. And the reason for that is that it's the same Hebrew letters that can spell either word. And then, how does this fit the fact that on Shavuot, the climax of Passover, when we think of the Omer count as linking the two of them together, how can we then at that time bring two loaves of what we call chametz, or leavened bread, and not matzah or oven, or not matzah or unleavened bread as a temple offering? When we remember that the first Seder took place on the 15th of Nisan before midnight, and so it took place, that first Passover did, while the Israelites were still slaves, then we realize, in a deeper sense, that Passover cannot possibly be our festival of freedom, because at best, historically, it's the festival of our expected freedom. In fact, even after we left Egypt the next morning, we only got as far as the desert. It was a while before we crossed the sea. You see, actual freedom then for our people had to wait until Shavuot, the day of the revelation at Sinai. No wonder Yeshua's brother James could say concerning what was given at Shavuot, it's the royal law of liberty or of freedom, James 1:25. And it looked forward as well, Shavuot did, to the time when we could later bring the first fruits, actually, of our Israeli produce to our temple. This period of true freedom and liberation remains, let me suggest, elusive to this day. Perhaps that's why Shavuot has not yet acquired a name of its own, a specific name designating the holiday. And perhaps it is then a picture or an indicator of the fact that we're still awaiting a future final revelation. Yeshua himself said in Yohanan's Gospel, John 8:31-32, "Know the truth, because the truth will set you free." And just prior to saying that, he said, "It's my teachings that are the truth." It correlates very nicely with part of the prophetic readings for this particular evening. The knowledge of God will fill the earth as the waters cover the sea. Next verse, and I will raise up for the root of Jesse a banner. We sang about root of Jesse as part of Lakato D. So perhaps that, looking forward to that future revelation, that future and final revelation. But nevertheless, we are commanded to count the days between Passover and Shavuot, just as we're commanded to count the years between the sabbatical years and between the twice a century Jubilee years. Each is an aspect of our march towards liberation. Liberation promised marches toward liberation attained. And by the way, the Hebrew word for counting, as you heard it already, counting in the Omer, is sefirah, the very word that was used in the portion that was read by Jenny, the word in which the ritually impure woman is commanded to count 7 days before her purification. Now, the root of sefirah is sapir, which is the blue-white color identified with divine majesty, and call it, for lack of a better term, purity in Revelation. Exodus chapter 24 and verse 10, when the elders of Israel, along with Moses and Aaron, went up to have a meal with God, it describes the, how should I put it? The tile work in front of his, or in his dining hall, so to speak, with this term. And that same term and that same color has therefore become the symbol of the commandments through the blue and white ritual tzitzit and of the blue and white that's found on the Israeli flag. Now, I want to pause here for just a moment and reflect on the symbolism that's on that blue and white flag. 3 weeks ago, I read this. The hexagram, which is that geometric figure you see in the center of the flag, and I'm quoting, while now primarily associated with Judaism and Israel, started off, as far as anyone knows, with King Solomon's signet ring. According to legends developed by Arabic writers, the seal was granted directly by God to Solomon. Later, it appeared together with a crescent moon. Remember, the moon is the symbol of God's commitment to his promises to David. Anyhow, it appeared together with a crescent moon on a Roman coin minted right around the time of Jesus. In 1354, Prague's Jews were given a flag featuring Solomon's seal and David's shield. Then 5.5 centuries later, it was chosen as the central symbol for a flag at the first Zionist Congress. I read that to you from a publication called Jewish Learning. Now, having read that, I pursued it a little further. Guess where I pursued it? Yes, of course, I Googled it. But in Wikipedia. And here's what I found in Wikipedia. I found that the seal of Solomon is, in fact, considered to be the signet ring attributed to King Solomon in medieval Jewish tradition. However, I found out also that a hexagram was noted on a Jewish tombstone at a place called Taranto in southern Italy. And that dates to as early as the 3rd century. But there's more. The hexagram does, in fact, appear occasionally in Jewish contexts since antiquity. For example, in Israel, there's a stone bearing a hexagram from the arch of a 3rd to 4th century synagogue in the Galilee. I know it's there because we've been there. It's in Capernaum. And you can see it. And then, in 1354, King of Bohemia, Charles IV, prescribed for the Jews of Prague a red flag with both David's shield and Solomon's seal. Step back. What did Solomon's seal look like, you ask? Thank you. Exactly like that, with a circle around it and dots in between the points. So anyhow, that was the flag. While in 1460, the Jews, and you got to love this, the Jews of Budapest, Hungary, received King Mattathias with a flag on which there were two shields of David and two stars. In the first Hebrew Siddur that was printed in Prague in 1512, a large hexagram appears on the cover. Inside is written, each person beneath their flag according to the house of their ancestors, and they will merit to bestow a bountiful gift on anyone who grasps the shield of David. By the way, not done yet. A number of years ago, I saw something interesting regarding this subject in the Jerusalem Report. And this is what I found. It has to do, again, with the tale of Solomon's seal. To start with, the image of Solomon's seal in Islamic culture is the six-pointed star, or hexagram, which we as Jews associate not with Solomon, but with his father David. Therefore, the Star of David is the seal of Solomon. Nevertheless, in Islamic legend, it is the seal of Solomon's ring which was said to be associated with the mightiest of the names of God. Why? Because when you consider the hexagram geometrically, it's a perfect geometric form. Interestingly, there are seven separate divisions in the hexagram, in the star. When the star is placed in a circle, as in all likelihood it was, as I suggested, as part of Solomon's ring, it has 12 parts. Now, as a reminder historically, 7 takes us back to the time of creation. 7 also reminds us of the holidays, because if you look at the cycle of our holidays, they are in cycles of 7. So this is a reminder, therefore, of our God, who's the God of both creation and history. And you might ask, so what does 12 remind you of? No, not the 12 apostles, but that works okay as well. The tribes of Israel, in other words, God's child, also called God's bride, God's people. So the seal of Solomon and the Star of David also then remind us of the God of Israel, God the 7, of Israel the 12, who made very concrete promises or commitments to David, which included the promise of Messiah. As we remind ourselves on a daily basis in the Amidah, paragraph 15, speedily caused to flourish the offspring, or the seed, of David. Now, in Israel, last Shabbat, as it is often here as well, the Haftarah portion was 2 Samuel 6 and 7. So what? Well, it's a big so, because in 2 Samuel 7, the closing paragraph of the parsha, God says the following, verses 12 to 16. It's his covenant commitment made to David. He says, David, you don't get to build this house. David wanted to build a house. Your son will build it for me. And in fact, God then goes on to say, and I will be like a father to your son. And even if he disobeys, though I might, the old English is chastise him. That sort of sounds cool. But I will not take my love from him. Because, then God concludes in verse 16 to David, your house and your throne and your kingdom will be guaranteed forever. David's house guarantees the Messiah. David's throne is where he will rule from, and David's kingdom involves Israel. And the promises were made to David, and a special handout, so to speak, to Solomon as well. Seal of Solomon, shield of David. Moreover, Yom Ha'atzma'ut in Israel is always preceded by Yom HaZikaron, Israel's Memorial Day, remembering the fallen soldiers that helped make possible the Day of Independence. And of course, those two holidays should be linked. But let me suggest something that perhaps is not quite as clear, but we've suggested in the last couple of weeks. It should also remind us of the important connection between Yom Ha'atzma'ut and Yom HaShoah, and of God's faithfulness then to us through the fire. Now, what happens in Israel is this. There's an official switch from Yom HaZikaron to Yom HaAtzma'ut that takes place a few minutes before sundown, with the ceremony taking place on Mount Herzl in Jerusalem, in which a flag is raised from half-staff to the top of the pole. And you understand the symbolism. So, what do we make of all this? You've just got to wonder, what is the message here? Well, as you wonder, let me suggest you be very careful as one person reminded us concerning wandering. Here's what he said. I wondered why the baseball kept getting bigger, and then it hit me. Let me suggest, however, in this case, the message is clear. We must remain eternally grateful for the initial signs of freedom, as well as for the divine promise that we will ultimately attain it. And we must even celebrate our days of preparation during which we attempt to ready ourselves religiously. And so we count the days between Passover and Shavuot, picturing the time from freedom promised to freedom yet to be attained. It remains a time not yet fully realized, but it's very much worth striving for. And in fact, we link our Passover Seder to our vision of liberation by reading the passage of the Bible recited by Jews bringing their first fruits to the temple. Talks about the wandering Aramean. It's when we were, remember, in Passover, we weren't in Israel, but we were looking forward to that time. A wandering Aramean was my ancestor, and then it talks about him bringing the first fruits to the temple. And so, interestingly enough, we revel in the fact that both Yom HaAtzmaut, Independence Day, and Jerusalem Day, which is coming shortly, both come out during this countdown between Passover and Shavuot. That perhaps is a reminder, it's a sign that our goal is closer than it has been, that ultimate redemption or liberation we await is perhaps not so far around the corner. It's also fascinating that although the Mishnah ordains that we recite the passage from Deuteronomy 26 until its conclusion, the Haggadah deletes the last three verses. Those verses read in part, and he brought us to this place and gave us this land flowing with milk and honey. And now, behold, I have brought the first fruits of the land which you have given me, O Lord. And you shall rejoice for all the good which the Lord your God has given you and your household. You, oh, and I love this, and the stranger who is in your midst, or the people who've connected themselves with you as part of your community, although perhaps not being born Jews. Anyhow, suggestion. Apparently, at least one negative result of our 2,000-year-long exile from the land was the deletion of these lines from the Seders that we had been celebrating on foreign soil. However, at an Israeli celebration of Yom HaAtzmaut, often takes place at home, in sort of a traditional barbecue with the family, In many places, you precede the blessing over the wine with a recitation of the chapter, or at least the first part of the chapter of Ezekiel 37, where the dry bones come to life. And then it's followed by a recitation of the three verses deleted by the Haggadah. These words serve as a confirmation of God having brought us back to our homeland, as that deleted text reminds us. And so they're a statement of hope, as well as faith, that we may soon see the restoration of the first fruit ceremony at the temple, and the promise of Isaiah chapter 2, verses 3 and 4, which is part of our service, that it might be fulfilled in our very lifetime, when the nations will go up to worship the God of Jacob. If we understand this, Passover, not just as the holiday of our freedom, but anticipated freedom. Shavuot, not yet fulfilled, for that matter, either as the holiday of the freedom that we anticipate. Then we will see that liberation is a process. And let me suggest that this, too, is part of the message of Dayenu, which we sing at the Seder. I'm afraid that often because of the familiarity of the tune and the fun of singing it, we sometimes overlook its message, which is teaching us how to be grateful for all the miracles that God has done and all the advances that we have made, rather than to be disappointed because of the periodic retreats and what remains yet to be accomplished. God has been faithful to us throughout our history. And he remains faithful to us on our personal journeys. And so it's appropriate to say this evening to say Shabbat Shalom and Yom Ha'atzma'ut Sameach. May the fullness of each of the holidays sink in. Take a minute of quiet reflection to allow that process to begin.